verse 3 of chapter 12, he says, "For by the grace of chapter 12, yes, by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, don't think of yourselves more highly than you ought to think." You smart Gentiles, or you whatever, don't. Yeah, it's okay. Thank you. "Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. For as in one body we have many members, not all the members have the same function, so we," here we are, "we who are many are one body in Christ. And individually we're members, one of the other. We've got gifts that differ according to the grace given to us." Paul wants me to be very sensitive to your gifts and you to mine, and me to your theology and you to mine, and all of us, you know, sensitive to each other's journey in response to the Spirit of Christ drawing us to him. So he wants the Jews and the Gentiles to be very sensitive to each other and stop locking themselves into positions and telling the others they're wrong or immature or whatever. So he starts with the various gifts that he's just naming. He could name another 50, but he names these ones. First of all, look at the gifts of the community. Some have the gift of prophecy in proportion to faith. What is prophecy? Well, here's my statement on it anyhow. Prophecy is a prayer gift. It's a gift of enlightenment by God, which gives insight into the mystery of who God is and what God wills, together with the gift to be able to communicate this insight to others. Prophecy doesn't mean foretelling the future. It's speaking out before. It's the same as the Latin proclaim. Someone who's in the community has that insight from God, from their prayer, to be able to find words to say, this is what we should do. And you could be in a group, could be anybody. Could be the bishop saying it. It could be Mrs. Somebody from down the road. It could be a teenage kid. Whoever. But somebody says it and people say, by Jove, he's right, you know. She's right. You've got it. That's it. You know how we do that in groups? Somebody seems to be speaking the truth. And it brings us all to that insight. That's the gift of prophecy. It's in proportion to faith. The measure of this gift is the measure of one's openness to grace and to the welcoming of the Spirit. Paul may also, in this statement, be affirming the need for discernment that the present word, claiming to come from the Spirit of Christ, truly does so and doesn't contradict the faith in the sense of the apostolic tradition that's come through the community. He makes that point elsewhere. He may also be wanting us to be careful here too, because the fact that I might get up and claim to be giving prophecy doesn't mean I am, does it? And the fact that you do, it doesn't claim that you are. So the group has to be very careful, constantly testing the Spirit, discerning whether it is prophecy. But one way of discerning is to see, is it consistent with the faith of the community? Is it consistent with that, or is it out on a tangent? If it's out on a tangent, well, we better bring it in again. Or ignore it, or whatever is appropriate. Let's just run through the rest of the gifts here that he mentions. We're still in verses 5, or verse 6 rather. Ministry is another gift. In ministering, this is diakonia. Ministering always means doing the will of the risen Christ. Serving. Servant of the Lord, not just helping each other out, though that's part of it. Then he goes into not the abstract noun, but he goes to the person here. I don't know why he shifts from the quality that the person has to the actual person, but he does. He says the teacher in teaching. Now the teaching job is not the same as prophecy. It's helping people understand the implications of the gospel for their lives. So it's relating the gospel to the philosophy of the day, to people's practical lives and all that kind of thing. Trying to find words to help people get the insight. The exhorter, parakaleo again, an exhortation. You call me, I call you. We're calling each other through love to behave differently, to whatever it might be. We're helping each other. The one who shares in single-mindedness, the leader in diligence. Now, the word spoude is the Greek there. And spoude doesn't just mean diligent. It means efficient, conscientious. It's a word that Paul used in the 2 Corinthians with regard to collection. So you've got to have know-how. And if someone's the leader of a community, let's say in our Catholic community, we often call that person a priest, well, we've got to be pretty careful, because what we've done in the past is the priest has pretty well led everything, kind of theoretically, even the money. He's the one who signs the checks and all that. And we've got to get away from that as far as possible. Otherwise, no one's going to become a priest. And sometimes a priest might have a really special gift of spiritual discernment. He might be a father, let's say, keeping that for a moment, of the flock in a very beautiful way, but he mightn't be able to handle money. And he mightn't have the gift of spude. He mightn't be very practical, but he might be just the person you want to go to when you want spiritual discernment. So let's be careful of asking a human being to have all these gifts, or you'll get nobody. So we've got, and the church is marvellously spreading this out now, where it's allowed to. I mean, the theory is do it. Well, and the person who's compassionate, well, merciful really, let them do it cheerfully. So it's just a fairly general statement of all the different gifts. Now, as will become obvious in chapter 14, there's a major difference, and I think I've touched that on already, so I'll leave it, the difference between Jews and Gentiles. Let's come now to why he insists on love. Let love be genuine. And the word for genuine, if you look at the Greek, is anhypokritos, not hypocritical. Not an hypocrites was an actor. Because the actor in the stage, the Roman stage, or the Greek stage, used to wear a mask. Now, the mask wasn't to hide the actor. The mask was to tell everybody who the actor was for the purpose of the play. And you, when you saw that mask, you knew it was Agamemnon straight away. You didn't have to introduce Agamemnon. That was his mask. And that was Iphigenia's mask. And that was Hera's mask. And that was Zeus's mask. Do you get me? So the mask identified you. But that's okay on a stage. But in real life, are you going to wear a mask? Am I going to wear a mask? Are we going to think we should be like somebody else? Are we going to be really yourself? Are you going to be open? This is what you get. This is who you are. Well, he's telling, let the love be really simple and not... Hate what is evil, meaning don't choose what is evil. Hate means don't choose. Love means choose. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with mutual affection. He's talking about Philadelphia is the Greek, the mutual affection, brotherly and sisterly love. And loving one another, philostorgoi, is a real feeling thing. It's a friendship at a very affectionate level. So be very affectionate to each other with this love of brothers and sisters in the community. Outdo one another in showing honour. Don't lag in zeal, same word. Don't be Pollyannas up in the air and all this fancy stuff. Be real with each other. Be practical and conscientious and etc. Efficient. Be ardent. Now, it's very hard to know who's right here, but the New Revised Standard Version says be ardent in spirit, putting the accent on our spirit. But whenever you use, and that's correct, but whenever you use the word spirit in the Bible, you're always talking about your relationship to the Spirit of God. It's always, Spirit isn't something you have, it's your breath. And you haven't got your breath, you have to breathe in, then you have to give it back. It's not part of your anatomy. So, whereas your psyche is, it's yours, and your body is, and all the rest of it, but your spirit is this gift. So it's always relational. Now, Paul is either saying, be ardent in your spirit, which I think he is saying, or he's saying be ardent in the spirit. And I think they're both there, so I'm putting a capital S just to keep that very alert to you. Serve the Lord, rejoice in hope, be patient in suffering. It's all fairly general, isn't it? But you, remember, he didn't know the community. He's heard of certain problems. That's why it's going to become practical soon. But these are general things that he's urging upon them, that he'd urge on anybody. Whereas if in these other letters, where he knows them, he's much more specific. Thank you. But it's still a nice summary. It wouldn't hurt to examine our conscience on any of this. Persevere in prayer. Because the moral life grows out of prayer, communion with God. It's not something we do, it's something that happens through us. Contribute to the needs of the saints. Now, some might suggest, remember the last letter he wrote, 2 Corinthians, before he came to Corinth, was all about the collection. And he's collecting money while he's in Corinth for the Jerusalem community. It's quite possible that since there was a very close connection between the Jews in Jerusalem and the Jews in Rome, closer than in all these other places, then he might also be inviting the Jews in Rome to, don't forget to support the saints, the community in Jerusalem who are poor. Could be that, but that's a guess. Extend hospitality to strangers. If it's important anywhere, it's important in Rome, because Rome's got a million population, 700,000 of them slaves, a whopping big population, and people coming and going all the time, every time there's a war or a battle or something else happening. So strangers are everywhere in Rome. So it's particularly important to be hospitable to them. And if you're not blushing and angry and upset about what Australia's doing to strangers, I don't know what you're doing. We've all got to be angrier about that. Dreadful, dreadful, shameful behaviour before the whole world. Bless those who persecute you. This is gospel stuff, isn't it? Bless, don't curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Have a common mind. Mind of Christ, of course. Don't be haughty. Associate with the lowly. Don't claim to be wiser than you are. Again, fairly general for the moment. Don't repay anyone evil for evil. Take thought to what is noble in the sight of all. If it's possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves. Leave room for the wrath of God. It is written, "Vengeance in mine I will repay," says the Lord. Leave justice, that kind of justice, to God, because God alone knows. Don't you take it on yourself to revenge things. Justice is done. Truth will out. Leave that part of it to God, because you'll only muck it up if you try and do it. No, if your enemy's hungry, feed them. If they're thirsty, give them something to drink. I think you know where Paul learnt that. He's right at the heart of Christianity. We either believe it or we don't. We go, you know. For by doing this, you will heap burning coals on their heads. That's a quotation from Proverbs chapter 25. Hopefully, they'll become ashamed. I'm treating you really badly. You treat me badly and all you do is make me badder. We'll fight it out and the might win in the short term, who knows. But if I treat you badly and you love me, it may not work. I may continue to treat you badly. But it's the only possible way you'll ever have of changing me. And if you do love me, like Jesus did on the cross, the soldier there might say, "Indeed, this is the Son of God." There might be a breakthrough. It's up to choice. But there certainly isn't any other way to bring about change. So they may be ashamed of their behaviour, your enemies, and they may change. Don't be overcome by evil. Overcome evil. Now, why do we keep forgetting this bit? With good. Well, we keep forgetting it. So we're not allowed to let evil conquer. But we have to overcome it. And the only way to overcome it is the way of God, through love. There is no other way. And if it means martyrdom, well, so be it. But overcome evil, says Paul, with good. But I also now want to do just one more scene, which is chapter 13, verse 1 to 7, where Paul, writing to Rome, talks about the relationship of the Christian community to the government, to Nero. This is prior to when Nero went berserk and the fire of Rome and everything, but at any rate, this is what he's saying, and I'll let it read, and don't forget, don't take it out of context. I'll read it and then comment on it. Chapter 13. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. There is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. Look at the next line, I'll come back on it, but this is the assumption behind what he's saying. Rulers are not a terror to good conduct. Brackets. I hope you can see he's not talking about a situation where rulers are a terror to good conduct. And he himself will resist the rulers of Rome, and he himself will be murdered for it. And so did the martyrs, and so did Jesus. He's not saying everything's fantastic, but on this assumption, in general, as a principle, rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Well, then do what is good. You will receive its approval. That might always be the case, but that's the assumption that he's working on. There's nothing in Christianity that is anti-government on principle. Do what is good and it will receive an approval, for it is God's servant for your good. Public service for your good. If you do what is wrong, you should be afraid, for the authority doesn't bear the sword in vain. It is the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject not only because of wrath, because of what will happen if you don't, but also because of conscience. Part of the community, you owe it to the community to fit in with the organisation of the community which is there under God's providence. For the same reason, you must pay your taxes. For the authorities are God's servants, busy with this very thing. Pay to all what is due to them. Taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honour to whom honour is due. So there's a statement of Paul, which has been taken out of context by dictators and violent leaders, and Christians are supposed to run around being nice to them. That's the conclusion they draw. It's got nothing to do with what Paul's saying. So just a brief comment. Remember, Paul is writing to Rome. It'll be less than 10 years before the war breaks out in between the Jews in Palestine and Rome. A stupid war, a war they could never win, a war that led to colossal destruction, to the loss of the temple, to the breakdown of Judaism. It was a folly from the beginning, but okay, that's what's building up. Now, what are the Christians in Rome, the Jewish Christians in Rome, know all about this? What are they going to do? What part have they got in it? Are they going to become a red brigade in Rome and start trying to do stupid things in this massively too powerful institution called Rome? What are they going to do? So Paul's writing to them and saying, because they're probably confused, should they side with their Jewish brothers and sisters in Jerusalem? Should they be anti-Roman? And the others are saying, why? You know, so where should they stand? Tension is growing between the Jews in Palestine and the Roman occupying forces. Paul is stating, as you can tell, that there's nothing in Christianity which demands on principle that we be anti-government. That's his basic statement. On the contrary, here we go, when you read the text carefully, on the generous assumption that government is legitimate and that, brackets, quotation, rulers are not a terror to good conduct. If they are, Paul has to write differently. But on that assumption, in a justly ordered state, civil authority is from God, and Christians are to be subject to it. His teaching is traditional. We recall the instructions given to the exiles in Babylon by Jeremiah. I think it's just common sense, really, but there it is. Jeremiah 29:7, Jeremiah writing from Jerusalem to the exiles, is saying, "Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find yours." Nothing Paul writes here is to be understood as taking away the right and duty to resist if and when civil authority acts against God's will. And as I said earlier, Paul's own death and Paul's own refusal to submit to the government in Rome when he got there is surely got to be read to contextualise this very sensible, overarching thing to be said to the community in Rome. Don't buy into the anti-Roman zealotry that's coming to you from Jerusalem. Don't get caught under it. Be a good citizen. Assuming, of course, that you can follow your conscience and that you're not being told to do something that's against your faith and that they are there for the good of the citizens, which is a good assumption to start from. Well, on that assumption, you are to be part of it because you have a role in society and you have a role to do in making the community more beautiful, not in standing against it. So with that, fairly general statement again, we conclude today's lecture, and next week we'll finish Romans.